It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the science of forgiveness and learn how and when it's okay to let go of feelings of anger and resentment. An international study in 5 countries finds forgiveness may improve your mental health. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Robert Enright holds the Aristotelian Professorship in Forgiveness Science in the Department of Educational Psychology at UW-Madison, founder of the International Forgiveness Institute. Robert, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much for having me, Kate. I'm honored to be with you.
Let's start out with some working knowledge and how you define forgiveness.
Okay. Well, I have studied forgiveness for over 3 decades, and I realize that not everybody agrees with what the definition of forgiveness is. But one of my quests was to find what is the true definition that cuts across cultures. And when I do that, I see 3 points for everyone to keep in mind. Number 1, you've been treated truly unjustly by other people, treated unfairly. 2, you make a choice. You shouldn't be forced into it or pressured to get rid of the negative thoughts, feelings, and behaviors toward the one who hurt you. And 3, and here's where it gets controversial, you actually strive as best you can today, and you might not even be able to do it, to do good toward the other in terms of thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. And that idea of doing good sounds completely outrageous, and it is, and it seems outrageous because we shouldn't be doing that. But because forgiveness is what we call a moral virtue, like justice or patience or kindness, all moral virtues flow out from the heart to good for others. And so forgiveness even does that when you're injured by others. 1 sentence definition of forgiveness: you're good to those who aren't good to you.
It seems, though, that the person, the victim here, has a lot riding on their shoulders, that a lot of this action comes from the person who has been hurt. Is there an imbalance here?
Yes, there is, because any moral virtue, my buddy Aristotle from 2,350 years ago told me that, in fact, you should never practice any of the moral virtues in isolation from any of the others. Here's an example. Let's say all you have is courage, and you're a non-swimmer, and you see a dog drowning in Lake Mendota. Well, if you don't have wisdom along with courage, you're likely to jump into the lake to save the drowning dog only to lose your own life. So when you have courage, you have to have wisdom alongside it. The moral virtue you absolutely must have alongside forgiveness is justice. So if you decide to have mercy on the other, that's what forgiveness is, ask something of the other. Be courageous too and stand firm. If someone keeps hitting you over the head with a frying pan and it hurts and you decide to forgive, ask the person through justice to put the frying pan down.
We're talking about forgiveness with UW-Madison psychology professor Robert Enright, founder of the International Forgiveness Institute. You can join at any point in the conversation, call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Robert, what is happening in the body? How do people suffering from serious trauma, how might they benefit emotionally, psychologically, even perhaps physically by forgiving those who have hurt them?
Well, we have to realize, Kate, that trauma can do a number on the body, both emotionally and physically. And we find that when people are deeply traumatized by others' injustice against them, it starts usually with anger. And that's good. Short-term anger actually is showing you, the victim, that you know what's right and wrong. You're a person who deserves respect, and it didn't happen, so you're angry. But If you don't have a way of getting rid of that anger, the anger becomes an unwelcome guest in the body. And that can eventually lead to anxiety and depression. And you know who the person oftentimes ends up not liking? Themselves. They believe the lie. And I see that over and over and over in our studies. Then with regard to the physical issues, the more angry you get, the cortisol levels can go up in the body. And that can lead to high blood pressure. It can lead to blood sugar going up, right? And the different areas of the brain can be affected, and you can have a lot of fatigue. And so here's the thing to keep in mind about not forgiving when you've been traumatized by others. The event itself is bad and hurts you, but what hurts you more is walking the pathway of life with all of that in your heart. So that person who hurt you could be long gone 30 years ago, and all of these effects are still in your heart. And I use the term, the person is winning twice. The person has won by devastating you and now leaving you with the toxicity in your heart that literally might not quit. Forgiveness is a cure for that.
If you are on the receiving end of that forgiveness, if you're the person being forgiven, what should you take from that? What should be in that moment for you?
If the person being forgiven is a reasonable human being, that person should realize how much pain was caused. There ought to be what I call the three R's within the person who did the victimizing: remorse, repentance, and recompense. And by remorse, I mean an inner sorrow. You know, I'm really sorry I caused you that much pain. Repentance is the verbal proclamation, I am sorry. And repentance is making up for it as best you can. Receiving forgiveness takes humility, because you have to realize you did badly. And a lot of people don't have that kind of humility. That's another moral virtue. But if they do, beautiful things can happen. Because then if this person practices what I call the three R's, remorse, repentance, and recompense, there's a possibility of reconciliation and maybe even a stronger relationship than before. But human nature as it is, sometimes when we say, I forgive you, the person will stand there stubbornly and say, for what? I did nothing, you're overreacting. It doesn't always come out with the happy ending like it does in the Disney movies, okay? Mm. And so we have to be ready for that and maybe forgive the person again for not accepting our overture of goodness when the person wasn't behaving in a good way toward us.
Why might it take a long time for a person to forgive another human being?
Because it's very, very hard to try to get rid of the negatives toward that person and the positives when your heart is wounded. Mm. I consider forgiveness to be the most heroic moral virtue on the planet. Again, moral virtues like justice and patience and respect. It's a lot easier to respect another person who's respecting you. It's a lot easier to be kind to someone who's being kind to you. But now, how do you be good to someone who keeps hitting you over the head with that frying pan? And that's not easy. So it's a struggle. And because it's a struggle, we have to be gentle with ourselves as forgivers and give ourselves time. I mean, just as one example, Dr. Suzanne Friedman, who's a professor at the University of Northern Iowa, courageously did a study with 12 incest survivors, one of the most horrendous injustices of the world, where a father or a father figure who's supposed to protect violates. Suzanne worked one-on-one with each of the incest survivors for 1 hour a week, until they, the participants, said, I have forgiven. It took about 14 months for them to accomplish that, and it worked.
UW-Madison professor in forgiveness science, psychologist Robert Enright, our guide to navigating personal transgressions and the power of forgiveness. be part of this discussion at any point. Call in with a question. You can add your views at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn the steps toward forgiveness with psychologist Robert Enright, who leads the International Forgiveness Institute in Madison and develops programs for people who have endured personal traumas. As we discuss the science of forgiveness, be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. You can add your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Robert, you model forgiveness as a four-phase process. Can you walk us through that process briefly?
Sure. First of all, we talk to hundreds of people about how they have forgiven, and we put together what we call the process model of forgiveness. And the first phase, we call them phases because it's like an analogy to the moon's phases. It takes a while for those to change. That's why we call them phases. And the first one is called uncovering the anger or uncovering your trauma. And a lot of people deny the depth of the hurt. And it makes sense because when you look within and you don't think you have a solution to it, there's a tendency to downplay the depth of your hurt. And so we look at the anger. We look at the dreams you have. I worked with one gentleman who had 20 years of every night having his father chasing him because of the abuse in childhood. Mm. You take a look at the fatigue. We take a look at the pessimism that oftentimes slowly creeps into the mind, where the glass is always half empty rather than half full because of the trauma you see. And so the uncovering phase is to uncover what has happened to you and the effects on your body and your emotions. Then we hit the decision phase, which is, how's it been going for you in terms of your healing? And a lot of times, not very well. And we say, well, would you like to try forgiveness? No force, no pressure. And usually the person says, forgiveness, scratches their head and frowns the face and say, sounds kind of outrageous. But we say, wait a minute, let me tell you what it is. You will try to be good to the other without excusing. What the person did was unfair, is unfair, and will always be unfair. You won't forget because it might happen again. You may or may not reconcile with the other. Forgiveness does not mean you automatically go back into a relationship. And as I said previously, you will bring justice alongside. Do you want to try it? Usually at this point, they've tried everything under the sun and they'll say yes. Then we enter what we call the work phase of forgiveness. We roll up our sleeves, we hit the forgiveness gym, and we try to become forgivingly fit. And that means looking at the other person in new ways. What I call expanding the lens of seeing the person, not defining the person exclusively by what that person did to you. We take a look at the person's personal history if we can. Most of us know the people who brutalized us, sadly. They shouldn't, but those who know us are the ones who hurt us the most. And we oftentimes see the wounds in that person. We see our common humanity. If you cut, you bleed. If the other's cut, the other bleeds. If you don't have good nutrition, you'll suffer. Same with the other. You're both going to die one day. You both have a common humanity. Hmm. And then if a person has a transcendent or spiritual perspective, we'll go there as well, but we won't if the person does not. For example, let's say we're talking with a Jewish person, and the person, has a Jewish religion. We would say, well, what about in Genesis 1, where it says you're all made in the image and likeness of God? Yeah, well, does that mean the person who hurt you is made in the image and likeness of God? And the person will say, oh, I wish I didn't know that. But it takes time to see the common humanity, the shared humanity, and the woundedness that you share. Then, when you see the person more broadly this way in the work phase, you tend to develop a little bit of compassion toward the other. In other words, the drip, drip, drip of anger in the heart slows down. And the compassion is a softening of the heart. And when that happens, we ask the person to bear the pain so you don't throw the pain back to the other who hurt you. And then once the person gets strong enough in the work phase, and here's where it gets controversial as a moral virtue, we say, if you're ready, can you give a gift to the one who hurt you? A smile, a returned phone call, maybe a kind word about the person to another. And that's where the healing starts. And then we hit the fourth phase, the discovery phase, where you find meaning and purpose in what you have gone through. You become more sensitive to suffering in others. And so you start leading your life to help others to alleviate some of their suffering. That's what happened with the incest survivors. Dr. Friedman and I were surprised. Many of them, not wanting to become professionals, wanted to help other incest survivors to heal. And at the end of the discovery phase, we find the big paradox of forgiveness. As you have reached out to the other who doesn't deserve it, but you're having mercy on the person, as you deliberately do that without abandoning justice, you know what happens? You, the victim, are the one who heals. You are the one whose anger goes down, whose anxiety goes down, whose psychological depression goes down, whose sense of self gets better, and your sense of hope gets better, and you're healed.
Thank you for taking us through those phases. UW-Madison psychology professor Robert Enright with us talking about forgiveness, founder of the International Forgiveness Institute. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. David in New Richmond. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. Say, I'm wondering if the professor totally dismisses the anger is a emotion that has power. And I think when there's people who have caused trauma in a person's life and they totally dismiss that they have and indicate that you are weak for even having that kind of emotion, and then continue to, you know, poke you in the eye. To me, a person that really shows they don't care, have no ability for regret or anything, I think there's power in holding on to your anger. You know, there was a time in my life where I just went through a health thing, and I told myself there's no way I'm giving in and maybe dying here. I'm not going to let that other person win in life. Same thing with business. You know, it's... There's sometimes I think there's a power with your emotion of anger that when you, I agree that maybe you're holding on to it might cause some inner trauma, but at the same time, it might give you some power to realize that, you know what, there's a reason for this emotion.
David, thank you. Robert, go ahead.
Thank you, David. That was very astute. And I want to make a distinction between short-term anger and long-term anger. Short-term anger is good because it shows you want something done. It can empower you. Long-term anger is the one that can turn on us. And that's the one we want to shut off. Because isn't it possible to strive for justice without anger? In fact, if the anger is with you so long, you can be fatigued enough where you don't have the energy or the enthusiasm to strive for fairness. What forgiveness does is revitalize you. And without the anger, you still have the determination. And there's a difference between anger and determination. And that determination can help you get something done in a fair way that doesn't become intemperate where it spills over to revenge. Because what happens with long-term anger, if you stay with it long enough, and now you're fighting for justice with hatred, it's not going to come out well, because you might ask for the pound of flesh, not for fairness. That's why I say, yes, let's celebrate the short-term anger and not get rid of that. Let's not confuse that with long-term anger. But with long-term anger, we see over and over and over again, it turns on the victim and actually thwarts fairness. Let's get rid of that, stay with determination, and maybe we'll create a better world.
Robert Enright is a professor of educational psychology at UW-Madison, founder of the International Forgiveness Institute. As we explore the time and place for forgiveness in our lives, the phases of it, be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the process of forgiving, what it may yield. A study in the Journal of Religion and Health finds forgiveness decreases anger, anxiety, and depression, and increases self-esteem and hopefulness. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Psychologist Robert Enright is a professor in forgiveness science at UW-Madison. Let's bring in Randy in Adams. Randy, hi. Go ahead. What would you like to bring up?
I just want to say that there's two parts to forgiveness. One is you have to forgive. And second, you have to forget. If you don't forgive, you don't forget. Hatfield and McCoy is probably one of the biggest feuds because of that. And by not forgiving, you hold that anger inside you. And then it goes on for generations. And then the generations don't even know why they're fighting the other generation. You know, why they're fighting the Hatfields, because they don't even know what happened. It's the same thing that's happening over in Israel and all these people that are coming over the border. You can't hold all your hate from over there. When you come over here, you have to forgive the person that's sitting next to you, willing to cross the border with you to make a new life. You have to forgive everything.
Randy, thank you for the call. Robert, over the past decade, you've made repeated trips to Israel and the Palestinian territories. What reception have you received there while talking about forgiveness?
Well, I only go in when invited, and I've given over 14 talks in that area of the world, and I've been yelled at 14 times. I'm 14 out of 14. I'm perfect in being yelled at. And the reason I'm being yelled at is as soon as I start a talk, invited in, remember, I say, I am not talking politically, everybody. I'm not talking about the Palestinian-Israeli issue. I'm talking about forgiving within your own family, within your own community. Because as Randy wisely said, when we deal with trauma that comes into our heart from others outside our community, we can end up displacing that anger onto the innocent people in our own family and our own community. That's what I want to talk about, everybody. Ready? They say yes. So as soon as I start talking that way, someone will raise their hand and say, you're here for the other side, just to get us to lay down and do whatever the bidding of the other is, sit down and write and shut up. And I say, well, that's not really what I'm talking about, but may I give you a question to see whether I should continue or not? And they say yes. And I then at that point give them a multiple choice question, A and B. I say, A, you will live without your land for the rest of your life. It's a land dispute there. It's a spiritual dispute and a land dispute. And you will live with resentment in your heart for the rest of your life. That's A. B, you will live without your land for the rest of your life, and you will be free of the anger that can bring you down and your family down. Which do you choose? In every case of these 14 times of being yelled at, people choose B, and then they let me continue. So it's a very contentious issue, because people automatically think that when you forgive, you lie down and let the other who's the other side walk all over you. That's missing the point of forgiveness and justice growing up side by side. And they, of course, don't let me get to that point before they yell at me. So it's always a challenge, but you know what? I love it because I know it stirs people in the heart. They're not yawning and falling asleep when I talk. They get all riled up. Why? Because it's important.
How difficult is it for you to witness this violence erupt in a place where you have worked to promote forgiveness?
Well, it hurts my heart because here's an analogy. Let's say there's a certain kind of pneumonia that doesn't really have a cure. And you, Kate, come along with a bottle of pills that 100% can cure that pneumonia. And people ignore it. And they continue coughing and passing on this virus to others, or a bacterial infection, I guess. Wouldn't that hurt your heart when you have a cure and people aren't paying attention? That's the way it is with me and forgiveness when it comes to different communities in conflict, different individuals in conflict, and families in conflict. We have a cure for the continued passing on of this resentment that Randy pointed out to us. Remember what Randy said? He said it can go on for generations. It's like a virus being passed down to the generations for hundreds of years. And I'm sitting here in my office knowing that if people would not substitute forgiveness for all the peace efforts that have gone on for the past hundreds of years, but add forgiveness to the equation, I think the peace movement would look qualitatively different than it does today. And yet forgiveness is off the radar and it hurts my heart.
I just, my heart goes to all the children caught up in these war-torn areas. What they go through. Can forgiveness be taught at an early age?
Well, you know, since the year 2002, I have been working in conflict zones with forgiveness education. And at the International Forgiveness Institute, we have professionally produced curriculum guides teaching children about forgiveness from age 4 to age 18. And we just had what's called a meta-analysis published in one of the highest journals in the world, Child Development, showing that when children and adolescents are introduced to forgiveness, their anger can go down. In fact, we even did a third grade study in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and the children's depression went down. And sadly, when we work in some of these areas, even as young as 6 years old, believe it or not, their anger level on the average for an average child in an average classroom is close to the clinical level of anger. When they learn about forgiveness through stories, seeing how story characters forgive without excusing, okay, without abandoning justice, we find their level of anger can go down to normal levels. And we have given away these curriculum guides in over 30 countries of the world. And the newest area that is coming to us is Africa. Just within the past year, people from Burundi, Rwanda, Malawi, South Africa, and just 2 days ago from Nigeria come to us and are asking for this kind of work so the children can be built up in forgiveness, so they don't bring their resentment into adulthood, impose it on their own family, and create a legacy of resentment, but instead a legacy of love. And so forgiveness education is very near and dear to my heart because we have to find a way to protect the children before they are infected with the trauma that their parents and their parents' parents' parents have passed down unwittingly. Let's not blame them. They don't do it on purpose. But they are passing on a toxicity that can end.
UW-Madison psychology professor Robert Enright with us, founder of the International Forgiveness Institute. Let's take another call. Liz in Lyon is with us. Liz, hi, go ahead.
Hi, I just was wondering how you learn to forgive. as generationally, my whole family was taught to never forgive as well as never say sorry.
And so, Liz, how has that affected you in adulthood, as an adult, when you were raised that way?
I mean, I still see it in my family because they never, my dad never forgave his parents for the way he was treated. I don't forgive my dad for the way he's treated me. No one has ever said sorry to me ever. And I say sorry, but it really, really, really has to be something really bad for it to be sorry. And I do hold quite a bit of grudges, because I don't know how to forgive people for the horrible things that have happened to me.
Liz, thank you for sharing and for calling in. Robert, what do you hear there?
Well, I hear that even Liz is saying, without coming right out with it, this is not good. Okay? And it's not good because to live with what she called grudges, think about what that does to your heart. And so one thing I have done is I have written books for the general public that people can pick up on their own. They don't have to go to therapy for it. And they can read these books. And we have actually brought these books, some of them, to, for example, to a maximum security correctional institution with good results. And so I don't want to here have an advertisement for my books. So I'll mention one of them. The earliest one is called Forgiveness is a Choice. And it works through the four phases that you and I, Kate, have gone through 20 minutes ago. And we do get good results when we do research on it, where people learn to forgive. They understand what it is. They willingly practice it. And for example, in the Maximum Security Correctional Institution, that used another one of my self-help books, the men, went from clinically angry, anxious, and depressed to non-clinical levels of all three of those, and they developed a general empathy toward people in general, which corrections experts tell me is almost impossible to do. So I walk people through the four phases in three of my books. You can find them on Amazon, and again, I don't want this to be an advertisement for my work.
In the prison setting, I wonder, how does forgiveness intersect with work in restorative justice?
Well, I think it adds a critical component, because restorative justice oftentimes deals with dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I find, unless you do the prior work of forgiveness, any one of us can enter into a dialogue civilly, but if we have hatred in the heart, that dialogue is not going to bear as much fruit as if we do the prior work. And it is desperately needed in corrections. Let me give you just one example. We interviewed over 107 men in a maximum security context. What percentage of that 100 do you think reported to us grave injustices against them when they were in childhood or adolescence? What percent do you think they're
most?
90%.
Wow.
Okay.
Mm.
So my question is, how will rehabilitation work when your heart is broken? I mean, think about it. As an analogy, if your knee is throbbing and someone tries to teach you algebra, what are you going to concentrate on, the algebra or your knee? Well, if you have rehabilitation in prisons and your heart is crushed, what's going to be your main focus? So I say, help people in corrections to first forgive those who have traumatized them, and then they'll be more open to traditional rehab. We know traditional rehab isn't exactly a winner. How do we know that? Look at the recidivism rates when people are released. How are we doing with people going back into crime? And why? They don't have the empathy. They're still taking out the rage onto other people. For example, when we did our study in Max, we had one gentleman who was convicted of 30 murders and suspected of 100. There's no empathy there. But his heart softened because of all he had been through in his life. And I think the world is better off with him having a softened heart. We need to see the pain in those in prison if we're going to be effective with corrections.
UW-Madison educational psychology professor Robert Enright with us on the processes for seeking and accepting forgiveness. There's space to enter the discussion. Call in with a question. Share thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with a UW-Madison educational psychology professor, Robert Enright, who travels the world researching and teaching plans for forgiveness, founder of the nonprofit International Forgiveness Institute. Let's bring in Paula in Fond du Lac. Paula, hi. What would you like to share?
So just to say that I have taken Dr. Enright's training on two occasions, and then I was able to implement a forgiveness group in a female corrections facility for nearly 10 years. And the one story that sticks out to me the most was a woman who had a lengthy conviction, but as she was going through the group, we got to the end, and she said to me that it took her 42 years and a moment to forgive. And that was one thing that has just still resonated in my mind and in my heart. I've since retired from corrections. But just to say that if we could do more of this work in corrections in the state and elsewhere, I think that would be a wonderful thing. It's quite my honor to be able to talk to you today, Dr. Enright. Thank you for your work.
Paula, thank you for your call and for bringing that story, 42 years and a moment, Robert Enright.
Paula, I'm so impressed with you for bringing forgiveness into correctional facilities, because it's not easy, because we have to, what we call, change the paradigm, not change it completely, as I said, but add forgiveness to it. And I think Paula's testimony is hugely important to show what can happen when you have the courage, which Paula has, to bring something new like this into corrections, where the emphasis too often is on punishment. I understand that because, as I said, this one gentleman who was convicted of 30 murders, people would say he deserves punishment, but doesn't he also deserve rehabilitation of his heart? Because it didn't just start with him sitting down and saying, I want to be mean. It started with profound pain that was given to him that he did not deserve. He, yes, made the wrong decision. I'm not saying what he did was right. I'm saying it was wrong. He made the wrong decision. But we have to understand the context of that. And if we can heal hearts, as Paula has been doing, thank you, Paula, for that, I think we're going to make the world better for those who've been abused and now are in prison, and make the world better for everyone else once they get out. We need to have the courage to see we haven't looked wide enough when it comes to corrections.
Lanny in Ashland is here. Lanny, hi. Go ahead.
Yeah, hello, Dr. Enright. I'm honored to talk to you. You're so right on with your thoughts. I've sold advertising most of my life, and I deal with people on everyday life. And, you know, you can't carry around darkness with you because it tends to wear you down. And I carried some darkness around with me, but the sooner you let it go, the lighter you feel. And just you're just so right on, you know, and I'm really enjoying this program because, like you said, I have a friend of mine who's in the probation department. And, you know, he's a spiritual kind of guy, but he tries to bring a good word to people. And forgiveness is the key. Even in Schindler's List, I don't know if you ever saw that, but Schindler said forgiving, because that way, you know, forgiveness is such a key. It really is, because you don't carry around any more burdens with you if you forgive people. And if they forgive people, if you can just spread the word and
spreading the word. Yes, Lanny, thank you so much for that. And Michael in Hancock is here as well. Michael, hi. What would you like to add?
Well, I'm a recovering alcoholic, been at it for years, and resentment, this holding of a resentment, is the number one thing that can get you drunk again. And we have a saying that resenting somebody who chances are is not thinking about you, that resenting somebody is like swallowing poison and waiting for the other guy to die.
Michael, appreciate you calling in. And Robert, I'm wondering what comes up for you as you hear from Michael and Lanny.
Well, I think they have wisdom because they probably walked a path of pain. And this idea of resentment is what I was calling earlier, long-term anger. And we have to find a way to deal with that. And I also have to admit to being shocked that Lanny said I'm right on with my thoughts because, you know, in starting forgiveness, so many people told me I was right wrong with my thoughts. How dare I bring something so soft and mushy into the hard-headed research area? And I actually had to battle through a lot of prejudice against this topic in order to bring it into the social sciences. I've never had so much to forgive as when I started studying forgiveness. So Lanny, thanks. You shocked me. Right on with my thoughts. That's not what people thought when I began 38 years ago.
In our last minute together, you know, in the decades since you started researching forgiveness, how have you seen the field of study change and what questions are you still working on?
Well, what happened, and this is good, people who are very, very skeptical of forgiveness doing any good at all in the social sciences, once they saw our scientifically based research, like what we went through with incest survivors and corrections, people finally came on board and say, hey, maybe there's something to this. And so I'd say my big issue right now is communities beset by violence and civil war, bringing forgiveness up from the individual level of individuals in their own hearts, forgiving particular people, to communities, starting a norm of forgiveness within their own families, within their own communities, and getting strong enough in that, that two communities that have been at civil war can meet together with the issue of justice, which has been happening for centuries, and put an overlay of forgiveness into the conversation. So you're really talking to a full human being. You give full worth to those with whom you're talking. I think the peace movement would change. I want to see forgiveness in the peace movement yesterday.
Robert, thank you for joining us.
It's been my honor to be with you, Kate, and thank you for all those great questions, everybody. I'm impressed.
Robert Enright holds the Aristotelian Professorship in Forgiveness at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.